Systematic rape has been used as a weapon to devastate communities and capture resources in South Sudan's civil war. But such atrocious crimes of war do not begin or end with military strategies. They have deep roots and impacts within politics and society. In this Conflict Research Program podcast, we discuss why sexual and gender-based violence has proliferated in domestic settings and displacement sites, as well as on battlefields during the war. And we consider what might be done to challenge stark gender inequalities in South Sudan. I'm your host, Rachel Ebreg, and I'd like to share with you some of the conversations I've had about patriarchy, toxic masculinity, and sexual violence as part of my research with the Conflict Research Program over the past couple of years. In my book, South Sudan's Injustice System, Law and Activism on the Front Line, I explored some of the ways in which patriarchal customary norms are implicated in licensing violence against women and sustaining violent conflict. My research showed that everyday efforts by lawyers and activists to challenge patriarchal norms are pivotal to ending the war and securing justice and peace. But sexual violence is a multifaceted problem. So in this podcast, we will hear from four other researchers who have spent years documenting and probing it from different angles. They'll discuss their work and offer their thoughts on how policymakers and civil society should respond. First, let me introduce a lawyer and researcher in the United Nations Protection of Civilian Sites in South Sudan. We can't use his real name, but we'll call him Chotlit. I asked Chotlit about the social pressures that men face and what relationship this might have with violent conflict.
Men in South Sudan do face a lot of challenges. The country has divided into tribal lines, into different political parties, and the life actually is not easy. Those who are not soldiers, they load their cattle, they load their food, and the situation actually is very tough. You can find some of them in the POC, some of them they run to East Africa, and some of them they're just surviving. Men are still doing their best. The marriage is still there because it is part of life. We have had some cattle, it's still paid the bride price. And this is why you've been hearing there are some cattle raiding in some areas. What encourages cattle raiding? People do marry and pay a lot of cows for you to get a wife. Immediately you will treat your wife as your property because you have paid everything for it. You risk your life to get a wife. 2 days back, there was a cattle raiding in Jonglei State, in which Morle they come and raid the cattle from Lawnwer. Maybe very soon the Lawnwer will go and raid the Morle. And the use of that cattle is to come and marry. And you, the cattle, as the mean for your survival, is one of the challenges the men are facing now at this current situation. But the issue of dowry become very complicated. A divorce cannot be granted if the cattle are not paid back, and the woman cannot be free. And another issue is, if you divorce your wife and there are some two cows who are not yet paid, it means that that wife should not go to another man. And if you have children and you want to leave to another man also, and your relative are no longer there, and you don't have resources to pay back, the husband will beat you every day. You have to force yourself to stay in that situation. So now for our daughters or for our wife to get divorced and go to other men is very complicated. It's connected with the issue of dowry. So actually, our women are still fighting with our culture. For people like me, somebody who is a lawyer, who knows a background about human rights laws or the Bill of Rights in South Sudan, because we have the Constitution and we have Article 15, we say that no marriage shall be conducted without consent of those parties. So it gives South Sudanese right to form a family of choice. But there is a condition within that article. It's saying that any marriage shall be conducted according to customary law. And when you talk of customary law, it means that you violate the article immediately. You are going to apply custom, which means that the Constitution now itself is looking at the customary law as sovereign law. We say that if you don't want change, change will change you. The young are trying now to come up with this change, but their parents. But if the child is educated and the father is not educated, the mother is not educated, there is a conflict within that house. For example, an elder may suggest to a daughter that a certain man has to marry you. But because you are aware of new life, new human rights, and the Constitution, you may argue that my father, I have right. Your father will say, no, you don't have right. In my family level, I don't know what call human right. Your right shall be determined by me as the father. So actually, this coming generation and our fathers or our ancestors, we are now having this kind of pulling rope. The children won't change, and the fathers, they still stick on their own customs.
So how do political and military leaders benefit from these customary norms?
Actually, the marriage and the military is not social like the marriage when the customary court are taking control. They are not part of human rights and they are not part of custom. In some areas controlled by the forces or by the soldiers, in which the local authority are not longer there, maybe people has been displaced. Sometimes some soldiers used to elope girls by force. An area controlled by the soldier, sometimes the life of girl are in danger. This is why you've been hearing about rape cases, about abduction. In 2016, after the fighting between the IU and the governments, there is a place called a checkpoint. That checkpoint was a place where the fighting actually was taking place. So when Dr. Machar withdrew from checkpoint, the place remained under the control of the government till today. And the problems, the IDPs were being in the camp for almost 1 week. So what happens? The first people whom decided to come out were ladies, especially young girls and young ladies. They have decided to go looking for food because there was no food. So what happened in that days? Most of the young ladies who came to checkpoint far through, they were captured and raped. After they were raped, they were allowed to come back to POC. When they come back to POC, some of them, they were admitted in IMC hospital, and some of them failed to report themselves to IMC because of culture, because of fear that if they went to IMC, what happened to them will be disclosed and the community will know them and they will be isolated.
Chodlith values his Nuer culture and identity as part of his life and work. At the same time, he is among an educated younger generation that is increasingly critical of discriminatory beliefs and laws that treat women as property and prevent them from reporting violence. And in many ways, he represents hopes for change in South Sudan. Let's now turn to Alicia Ludka, a fellow of the Conflict Research Programme. Alicia's ongoing doctoral research enters into debates about global efforts to respond to and prevent gender-based violence. Her extensive research in South Sudan with affected people, militias, and youth gangs explores gender norms and rethinks how to promote gender equality in this complex conflict setting. We asked her to share her findings on sexual violence and to highlight what policymakers need to know about how to confront it.
Today I'm just going to briefly use insights acquired from past research projects in South Sudan to talk about the local political economy of sexual violence, exploitation and abuse in the conflict, and the ways in which international discourses and policies have affected such violence. So wartime rape and other related offenses have been a consistent feature of South Sudan's conflict since the war started in December 2013, with sexual violence really becoming emblematic of the broader protection concerns faced by civilian women. And unfortunately, this kind of sexual violence isn't new in South Sudan. Even during the Second Sudanese Civil War, the bodies of women had functioned as a reward for the hardships of SPLA soldiers. So Clemens Pinaud's work has shown that commanders, through gifts of bride wealth and wives to their subordinates, form lower stratums of followers that help them strengthen their positions within the SPLA. In her study of intercommunal violence in Jonglei State, Lizzie Lacey showed how women's bodies were used as legitimate spoils of war and intercommunal violence, and how abduction, sexual slavery, and rape in the context of such violence were the result of customary bride wealth practices and underlying patriarchal structures that emphasized women's role in commanding value for the payment of cattle. More recently, Hannah Logan and I similarly argued that conflict-related sexual violence in the current war could not be abstracted from the local political economy in South Sudan, particularly patrilocal bride wealth-based marriage practices that commodify women's identities and bodies. Against the backdrop of a collapsing economy, government soldiers and their allied militias in various offensives have given soldiers and armed youth license to loot and pillage, where the bodies of women and girls are treated like a form of property to be looted like any other in the course of fighting. A lot of the participants that I've spoke to over the past number of years have actually often equated the pillaging of civilian property to the abduction of women. And again, this violence is very much rooted in everyday structural violence that women and girls experience in South Sudan, and the commodification of women and girls through bride price practices, which both underscore and often violently reinforce gender roles to the detriment of women and girls' agencies, and particularly ownership over their own bodies. So throughout the years of doing research, I've noticed the various ways in which sharp economic decline in South Sudan, particularly in context of the war, but especially since December 2015 when they free-floated the currency, have augmented the already dowry-dependent local economy in which parents view their daughters as the only source of wealth. And this has left females in South Sudan with even less control over their reproductive and productive labor and has really tied female sexual agency to resource access in ways that are quite extreme. And it's not just through bride wealth that women's sexual agency in South Sudan has become increasingly circumscribed by material circumstances. There are very inherent links between the physical security of female populations and the dire economic and food security situation in the country, with many women forced to make the choice between the possibility of sexual violence on the one hand and being able to feed their families on the other. And this has produced massive shifts in the gender division of labor. And while this can be expected in any conflict-affected situation, where women often become the breadwinners for their families and communities, quite severe in South Sudan, where women are forced to proactively confront armed men and to have almost completely taken on the roles associated with male household members. And these sorts of links between women's sexual agency and resource access have produced a variety of so-called knock-on effects. From a gendered perspective, men are no longer able to provide for or protect their families, which is an important element of South Sudanese definitions of masculinity. And those who don't join the fight, either on the side of IO or the government, have almost been rendered idle by the dire security and economic circumstances in the country. And as is the case with other countries in the Horn of Africa, war and state collapse in South Sudan have created inequalities between men themselves, generating clear categories of winners and losers, such that powerful actors are actually able to exploit the vulnerabilities of males in society. And aside from the very obvious, albeit ignored, impacts that these changes have on men's mental health, in many cases that I've come across in different parts of the country, these shifts in gender relations and the inability of men to live up to idealized norms of masculinity have led men to channel their frustrations into violence and sometimes try and violently uphold a gendered order that is rapidly changing. Another knock-on effect, and I think one that is understudied in South Sudan, in terms of the links that I've been talking about between women's resource access and sexual agency and the gender division of labor, is the increasing propensity of women and girls to engage in survival sex in order to make ends meet or to participate in the informal labor economy, which opens them up to various forms of sexual exploitation and abuse. So I was recently in WOW, where I heard numerous cases of women and girls going to so-called lodges, particularly adolescent females, where there was a high concentration of NGOs and businessmen and government officials, where they would engage in survival sex or prostitution, if you will, with this becoming so frequent that some key informants called it an everyday occurrence, that they were getting cases of this 3 to 4 times per day. A lot of families, in the same way that they were selling their daughters off at younger and younger ages in terms of bride wealth, were also said to be forcing their daughters into sex work in order to be able to make ends meet. And it should be noted as well that this kind of survival sex is just a more institutionalized version of the mistreatment and structural violence perpetrated against individual women and girls who continue to be used for transactional purposes, but just in a different way in the context of the war economy. Women in the informal economy or informal labor practices are particularly vulnerable, it appears. So many women who are working as tea sellers or domestic workers end up being vulnerable to predation by customers, whether consensually or not, which is made worse by perceptions of women in the informal economy as sexually open or sexually permissive in a lot of parts of South Sudan, as is the case across the Horn of Africa. And I should say as well that it's not just women and girls who are being forced to engage in sex work. I have also heard of cases of men and boys, particularly adolescent males and male youth, who are trading sex for money with older females or elderly women in various parts of the country, or with men as well. So the obvious question, with this sort of very bleak picture that I've painted, is what can be done about it and what is being done about it? Again, violence and atrocity are deeply rooted in South Sudan in general and against women and girls in particular, and grounded in the structural violence connected to the functioning of the local political economy and increasingly so the war economy. But unfortunately, most policies and programs that have attempted to combat sexual violence and enhance women's rights in South Sudan have often been compacted into unrealistically short timelines and have not been very responsive to South Sudan's unique sociocultural or economic context. And there are very real consequences to this, one of which that I've seen consistently and others have seen as well, like Sherry Leonardi, is a veritable pushback against women human rights in the country, which is often seen as an imposition by international actors. So many people have heard people blaming that thing of human rights or human rights both as an abstract concept as well as sort of a physical entity for the problems in their communities, including rising criminality and even sexual violence itself. And I think a lot of this has to do with the ad hoc diffusion of liberal human rights frameworks in the aftermath of the Second Sudanese Civil War in 2005, which often has to do with the ways in which external actors ignored how individual rights or concepts of individual rights conflicted with social and economic systems based on patrilineal structures and bride wealth. And the exclusion of these local perspectives and contextual realities, including the economic realities in which acts of sexual violence are rooted, can also lead to the violent reinforcement of patriarchal underpinnings of gender relations as other actors seek to resist change in the gendered order. I think way more work needs to be done on sexual and gender-based violence against men and boys in the context of the conflict. There's numerous incidences of sexualized targeting against males, including male rape, but also genital trauma. So one thing that you hear a lot of in South Sudan and in periods of heavy fighting is things like castration. And while that's sometimes viewed as a form of torture, it has very real gendered implications in terms of both literally and figuratively cutting off the lifelines of communal survival. But there's also sex selective killing, forced recruitment, arbitrary detention, and other acts of gendered violence which specifically target men. And I think understanding the gender dynamics of those types of violence is quite important. I do see it as an important part of the South Sudanese feminist project, since it's the very same gender inequitable norms that make sexual violence against women possible that also make it possible to exploit men's vulnerability.
Alicia's findings and recommendations help to illuminate the scale and complexity of gender-based violence during South Sudan's current war. But our next speaker, Angelina Daniel-Seeker, has been working for decades to expose violations of women's rights and to demand an end to impunity. So, Angelina, the first thing I'd like to ask you is why you think rates of sexual and gender-based violence are so high in South Sudan.
The issue of sexual violence or sexual harassment against women in South Sudan, this a long story, because within the family, there is violence and sexual violence or harassment happening, but they are not reported for any authorities. And sometimes when it is happening, it ends up with marriage, when a man rape a young girl. And it was like something not organized for, but the chief will decide to bring both of them and say, okay, now you have done this one, you have to marry the girl, especially when it end up with pregnant. And another part of it is that during the conflict, it become very high because the two tribes that most was fighting, they target the women as the weapon of war to affect the community, but it's continue no accountability. So within the family or community, there is no accountability, or it is end up by marriage, and it is encourage boys especially that if I do anything, I will not hold accountable. So it become like a normal practice that they are doing. So I think women really affected in the society with this practice of sexual violence. But the most problem is that they are not reported to the authority, the official authority, like a police, and that she also can seek a medical support during these 72 hours that it's supposed to get some treatment. They are not doing it. And you can see it can affect their life, it can affect their health in the future, and especially for younger. If we take part of the early marriage, it is one of the sexual violence also against a woman when you get a girl of 12 or 13 years old. They forced marriage. You can see how it is end up with the women's situation.
I wonder whether you think part of the explanation could be due to the pressures on young men to pay a dowry in order to marry.
Not all the South Sudanese community get married with this high pride, especially in my community, my mother, and even myself. Our marriage was not cost a lot of money. But it is changing now. It's changing because people are following the modern way where the marriage can cost thousands of South Sudanese pounds because they want to make like a show. So it's put the men in the pressure that you can see the economic crisis or even lack of employment in South Sudan. So young boy and young girl, they end up in relationship. And they avoid going for marriage, but they end up with a relationship. But after the years, maybe they have even 2 to 3 children, they come to the family and the men will come and say, okay, now this is my wife and children, so I want to pay something so that they make our life legally. Otherwise, the most community that affect the girl or the boy in each of the high pride is where you can see the youth can attack other community to get the cows so that he can marriage, you see. So it ends up in the conflict where they can kill themselves or kill a number of that community and took their cow. And again, tomorrow they will come with the revenge against this one. So it's bring conflict among the people. All this because the boy want to get rich with the cows and marry the loved one.
Could the legal system be used to regulate this problem? And what role might chiefs play in this, for instance, especially when it comes to customary courts?
The South Sudan Constitution 2011, the transitional constitution, recognized the local government that include this chief and all these people. They give them power to do the process of the court related to the family issue. But I think what they should do is some cases that it's not easier for them to handle, they can just transfer to the official court. But what we try is to advocate for the family law. We will encourage the chief to implement these laws because the issue of the early marriage, they must stop it. The issue of the high price for young people to get married, it is challenges for them. Also, sometimes there is a conflict where, for example, somebody kill somebody from the other community or family. What they will do is like a girl composition, to take a young girl from this community and give it to that community, like replacement for the disease. And this is all against the women's and girls' rights. Problem is, our voice is not heard.
Finally, I'd like to ask you if you think the trial for crimes committed against humanitarian workers by government soldiers at the Terrain Hotel in 2016 will have an impact on wider efforts to confront sexual violence.
I think that can make a difference because all the people are supposed to have a right before the court. The humanitarian workers get the process to access this court and make the hearing of the court. So I think women of South Sudan can use it as a chance that, okay, we are all women, we need to have the same process. So what we encourage the women is that this is a good chance, but I'm not sure it is the women who affected seriously during the 2013 to 2016 civil war in South Sudan. Because those women, they are still in the camp, in the POC. They cannot access any justice process with the South Sudanese authority because the risk. So they just stayed with their grievances inside the POC. By the time they will come, maybe it will be just reconciliation. And it's difficult for women to put the finger on the army that was the man who raped me. It's very difficult because the behavior of the army can put her in the risk for her life. But I want to say, yeah, it can be a chance for the women of South Sudan to hold these people accountable for this crime, but it is difficult because the evidence is already disappeared, for example, because they did not get any access to the service or the medical report that can help them in this process. So I think the chance is here, but also the challenge is there in the other side.
Thank you, Angelina. We'll now go to our final speaker, Jock Madut Jock, one of South Sudan's foremost anthropologists. Jock's research among Dinka groups during Sudan's Second Civil War broke new ground in gender analysis of conflict. He identified the emergence of hypermasculine, militarized identities alongside the intensifying pressures on young women and men to marry and acquire children. More recently, he has turned his attention to the question of why we still see increased rates of sexual violence among South Sudanese in the diaspora. I asked Jock to take us through some of his findings and to explain their implications for future work on peace and security in South Sudan.
What I'll do is describe the situation with what is essentially a scourge of sexual violence in South Sudan and then why it is happening in the diaspora. For a very long time, South Sudan has been reported to have really heart-wrenching levels of sexual and gender-based violence. These reports have been done by rights groups, academics, and practitioners in the field of rights and law and humanitarian studies, journalists, community groups, and sometimes survivors or victims themselves. Studies have explained sexual violence in South Sudan in terms of the madness of war. And incidents of sexual violence date back throughout the 1980s and 1990s civil war, especially that which was being done by Sudanese armed forces stationed in garrison towns throughout South Sudan, especially the big one, Malakal, Wau, Juba, Torit, where sexual violence was being used as an underhanded way of trying to cow the opposition armies of South Sudan, especially the SPLA, by targeting women as a way to aim at where it hurts the most. South Sudanese soldiers themselves also being reported to have engaged in some of these heinous acts, although much of the period of the SPLA from 1983 to 1991 had very strict punishment of soldiers who engaged in sexual violence. Since the split of the SPLA in 1991 and all the way to 1998, all of that conflict, especially in the triangle region between Lakes, Unity, and Warap or Bargezal back then, that area experienced quite a lot of breakdown of norms that once safeguarded against such behaviors. So it has been explained in terms of the madness of war and the loss of cultural tradition that would have stood up against such a practice. But what about certain practices that predate the war? What about the times when there is no war or before the war? What was the cause? Why did it happen? Well, there is the issue of gender socializing and the station of women in society, in the hierarchies of society, where women's bodies tend to be seen as property. And as a result, sexual violence happened in a variety of ways, not in a systematic way as it did in the war times, but it happened in domestic setting, it happened in the community because of the way the gender socialization has structured the relationship between men and women, where men seem to have been allowed to their own devices for a long time and women being made to be more submissive and unable to speak up in so many social settings. And so while the war may have exacerbated the rate of sexual violence, it is not entirely to be blamed on war. There are political and cultural practices within South Sudan, as it is in many other African countries, that make it possible for many men to get away with sexual violence. But if we can say that culture and the political climate are responsible for the rise in sexual violence in the last 40 years in South Sudan, one has to wonder why it happens in the diaspora. If these young people are removed from the political and cultural climate that makes it possible, one would have imagined that it would be reduced. But it happens a lot. There has been a massive campaign on social media, particularly on Twitter, where a group of young women and girls who call themselves survivors of sexual violence have really embarked on a campaign to expose and shame their attackers and the perpetrators. And it has created a lot of turmoil in that society. And answering my question about why it happens in the diaspora, since we are saying that the reason it happens in South Sudan is because of war, but it's also because of the cultural and political climate that exists there, the reason it happens in the diaspora is that so many of these socialization mechanisms are carried to the diaspora by families. And in fact, they become even more stringent and stronger in the diaspora because diaspora communities are worried that if they don't enforce some of their traditions, that they would lose it since they are living outside the context of their traditional setting. And so the more families struggle to maintain their traditions and their cultures, the less the diaspora is able to deter sexual violence. Even though these are countries of laws, these are countries where individual rights are maintained, there is also that issue of dealing with a new climate, with racism, with prejudice, even in the legal setting and even in the law enforcement like police. The same way that back in South Sudan, the laws have failed to uphold the rights of victims or survivors. We've realized that the legal system does not really work in favor of this. For even in the police and in the courts of law, there is a tendency to see these incidents of sexual violence from a moral point of view, such that the first reaction by all these institutions, just as it is with the families and communities, is to question the veracity of the stories presented by girls and young women. And so if there is a moral approach to an issue that is supposed to be purely legal, then a crack is created for victims to fall through.
This podcast has touched upon a growing body of research exploring violence against women in South Sudan. It's not a coincidence that men are the major players in the violent competition for power that Alex Duval describes as a political marketplace. Indeed, Clemence Pinault has shown how some of these leaders raised their status as commanders during the Second Sudanese Civil War by accumulating cattle and paying bride wealth gifts to their subordinates. International humanitarian actors are clearly conscious of the issue and have established programs aimed at protecting women and preventing sexual violence. But perhaps equally crucial is the support that some of them have given to promoting education in general, and girls' education in particular, in a country with the lowest literacy rate in the world. Women in South Sudan and in the diaspora are getting organized, and some have taken to the streets to demand an end to rape and an end to the war. Many South Sudanese men, especially young men, no longer believe that the commodification of women is simply part of culture. and they are already finding creative ways to challenge injustices in their communities. So we've reached the end of this podcast, and it only remains for me to thank all our participants for sharing their experiences and their research on this sensitive and deeply troubling issue. This Justice Networks podcast was supported by a Conflict Research Programme small grant held by Dr. Rachel Ebreg at Goldsmiths, University of London. The CRP is an international research consortium led by the LSE and funded by the UK Department for International Development. However, any views expressed do not necessarily reflect the UK government's policies. David Meffey was our editor.